Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette Recaps. I'm Greta Johnson.
I'm Trisha Bobita, and joining us as always is Peter Sagal.
I'm sorry. Did I interrupt your train of thought?
Oh, now I'm scared.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Today we're recapping the 1994 Quentin Tarantino film Pulp Fiction. This is actually our first Oscar winner that we
That's interesting. Although it
chosen.
Won the Oscar for Best Screenplay, right? Nothing else.
Yes, Best Screenplay.
Right. Okay.
I did watch it with subtitles on so I could appreciate the writing more. That's a thing
yes.
I actually do.
I know.
Yeah.
If I think I'm going to like the writing, I like to read it as I watch it.
Yeah, no, I think that makes total, especially because in a lot of the, like, the conversations go pretty fast
yeah.
in a lot
yeah.
of these. So, like, I find it very helpful to have those subtitles.
Greta, you said on Twitter that you had never seen it before.
Right.
So you saw it for the first time. Trisha, had you seen it before?
Nope, not till last night.
I'm going to express surprise, even though I didn't see last week's movie before we talked about it, only because, like, this is just such an incredibly seminal movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think what's funny about it is, and Trisha, I'm curious if you felt the same way, but there were, like, certain things about the story that I knew were going to happen.
Right.
Because it is, like, just from, like, cultural osmosis.
Yeah.
I've heard so much about Pulp Fiction, and I listened to the soundtrack a lot when I was in high school. So I felt like I had a sense, like I was going to recognize it, even though I had
right.
never seen
you can
it,
go
which I
to
did.
You can go to one of those, you know, quote movie quote websites on IMDb or elsewhere, and practically see the entire screenplay.
Yeah, totally.
Because almost every exchange in it has been immortalized as a great movie quote.
Right, like that the whole Royale with cheese thing.
Right.
I totally knew.
And so it just, I mean, I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying it's interesting that you guys knew this and you knew this movie had like so influential and popular, and you never said, maybe I should see it.
Well, I was really worried I was going to hate it.
But you liked the music.
Yeah. Why were you worried you're going to hate it?
Right. But partly because I loved the music in Reservoir Dogs, but I did not like that movie either.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, Tarantino, they're so violent. They're often really self-indulgent. I did lie about the 3 hours thing. Turns out it was more like 2.5 hours, which, you know, I was glad to see that. But yeah, I thought it was just going to be like long and violent and woman-hating and uncomfortable, pretty much.
And was it? To skip to the end?
I liked it a lot. I think we could have had almost none of the Bruce Willis storyline, and I would have been totally okay with that. But I enjoyed watching this movie a lot.
Okay. Trisha?
What did you think, Trisha?
I liked it a lot, too. And I like a lot of other Tarantino stuff. I've seen most of his later work, most of his work maybe in the last decade or so. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I adored. So it was definitely, for me, one of those movies where I had just missed it. And it just never, since it's not, let's be honest, since it's not on the things I already subscribed to and wasn't just in front of my face in terms of Netflix or Hulu or whatever, it wasn't just there. As I was looking at old movies ever in the last few years, I'm sure I would have watched it before now. But that's why I'm excited about this podcast, is because it's making me go back and watch things that I just missed.
Right.
So what you're saying is if there were like an R-rated version of TBS where they just like played the same movie over and over, you would have seen Pulp Fiction by now.
Yeah, like if on Christmas they showed it for 24 hours straight. Then I would have seen it by now. Also, Peter, you have
weird.
To understand,
yes.
I consume a lot of pop culture, but mostly it's The West Wing over and over again.
I understand. And there's only so many hours in the week, and most of them
there's
are filled up with rewatching
so
The West Wing.
So many hours to rewatch West Wing.
Let's be reasonable in the demands in your time. So
yeah.
It's always really interesting to go and see a movie that you've heard about your whole life, that's like people reference all the time, and there it is. So what did you guys think? Did it live up to the hype?
I think so. I, as somebody who really loves short stories as a thing to read, and who likes sort of clever banter, this movie had both of those things in spades. I also thought that Samuel L. Jackson was even better than I thought he was going to be somehow, even
amazing.
Though everyone had told me he was going to be the greatest in this movie. And I liked the way they played with time. I liked the way, we sort of bookended the story with the first, you know, couple in the restaurant and the last scene of the movie. I liked the architecture of it a lot. I thought that it was interesting, and in the way that I usually feel about Tarantino, like, yes, there are things that I find problematic in terms of depictions of women, and you know, I'm not a huge fan of how violent it is. That's not the draw for me. But I also just really respect the hell out of the fact that his movies feel like one person's vision realized in a way that's interesting to see. It feels more like reading a novel to me, where it's like, oh, one person had most of the roles, like had most of the creative authority, at least.
Yeah.
And where some movies can feel like they're camels because they're horses designed by committee.
Yeah.
Tarantino films don't feel like that to me. They sometimes feel too long because maybe he did need somebody to tell him to cut that one thing. But he gets to make the movie he wants to make. And there's something sort of exciting about the idea of an artist getting to make the thing they want to make and then getting to see it.
He is definitely one of the few movie directors who legitimately deserves to like be the basis of an adjective. Like Tarantino-esque. You know?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you can't say that about like Tony Scott, you know? It's like Tony Scott-esque. What do you mean? Like competent Hollywood movie making? Yeah, he's really he's definitely an auteur.
It's interesting, Trisha, to hear you use the word realize with Tarantino in the way he makes this, because the French word for director is réalisateur.
Ooh, drop some of the French on
us. And I love that. The idea of just like making it like real, you know, because he does do. And I think that so much of it too is like the framing of everything.
Yeah, it's
like
beautiful.
He's so good. Like you see exactly what he wants you to see and no more and no less in every frame, which is just really like it's a good ride. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, I'm glad you guys liked it. I was surprised I liked it so much. I had seen it when it came out. It was a big deal. Tarantino, as you guys had already mentioned, had made this indie hit, Reservoir Dogs, which everybody freaked out for because it was so cool and yet so small. And he did it all with like filmmaking bravado and acting and
it's in black
writing.
And white, right?
No, but it could be. I mean, it's such a small movie, and
yeah,
it's all just
I
about.
It
I mean,
was.
It's like some. It's like the best movie you could make with essentially a budget of $4,000. It's incredibly good, and everybody's like, "Well, what's he going to do next?"
And to this day, the Reservoir Dogs poster is in 47% of college dorm rooms.
Right, right. And
I am going to just say one more time, that soundtrack is amazing.
It's amazing. And then this movie was his follow-up. He's going to write and direct. He had a bigger budget, although not that big, weirdly. And it won the Palme d'Or, some award at Cannes, and they rolled it out with such extraordinary ability to make it the movie event that everybody had to go see. And I went and saw it, and I loved it at the time, but I have not liked most of his movies since then.
Uh-huh.
I think they've gotten increasingly repetitive, and they've shown up his basic weakness as an artist, which is that he doesn't seem to know a lot of actual human beings and how they act, which can become wearing. And, you know, and you can talk about the things he keeps coming back to again and again and again. So I was like, well, since I assumed that, you know, I hadn't seen any of that stuff before when I saw Pulp Fiction, which is why I liked it. Now I will go watch it again and see it has the same dumbass things he's been doing for 20 years. So it won't be that interesting. I was wrong. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was because he hadn't worn those tropes out yet. Maybe it was because he went at it with excitement.
It was the first time he played that deck.
Yeah. But I, for example, one of the things you mentioned, Trisha, the way it plays with time.
Yeah.
Just.
Yeah.
I remember delighted me because it was always something I had been interested in as like a reader and a writer is like how you know, fool people as to what time it is and going back and forward in time. And when I realized that we were going back to the day prior, however many days prior, when John Travolta's character was still alive to finish the movie, I was like, oh boy.
Yeah, you had to have a character killed off, but then be back.
Yes, and the reveal that storyline, the Travolta and Jewel story, I'm sorry, we're going to use their character names, the Vince and Jewel storyline intersects with a Honey Bunny and Ringo storyline at the end of the movie. It's like, oh, this is great. It was the same place. That's, oh my God. I loved it. It also had some things that I had not remembered. He hasn't done well since then. Like, he's not really good at, like, human relationships. He doesn't really understand, it seems, in a lot of his later movies, how people relate to each other than through violence.
Yeah, that's true.
Most of his interactions, most of his scenes between people, as delightful as they are written, are really about, is this person going to kill the other person or not? And it's a lot of tension leading up to the final decision. Like that, like 20-minute scene in the basement in Inglourious Basterds is like the quintessential Tarantino scene. Are they going to kill him? is he going to get killed? Oh
my
God,
I feel like some of that is definitely in this movie.
Yes, absolutely. You know? Which is, God, yes. I mean, the whole scene in the apartment, you know, when Jules and Vince walk in, that whole sequence is basically about rising tension until he kills everybody.
Yeah.
But in this movie, I had forgotten, the scenes between John Travolta and Uma Thurman are genuinely sweet.
They're
buy that they're attracted to each other, that they're intrigued by each other, that they're relating to each other as human beings. And then, of course, something else happens, which is something else to talk about. But I was like, all right, yes, this is a movie filled with recognizable human beings. I kind of enjoy it.
In the way that, like, movies that I certainly would watch, but like a Bond or a Bourne movie, the people who are the hitmen are sort of these machines.
Right.
Right.
Before we see these guys scare these dumb young hamburger breakfast eating kids, we hear them sort of bickering in the hallway, and then they're like, oh, hang on, it's too early. Like, all the references to how early in the morning all this awful stuff is happening are cracking me up too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so they've already taken the wind out of these guys' sails as like tough guys for us as an audience before they go in and start threatening people with guns, which is a very fun thing to do in this movie.
Yeah, it is. I think, so we have some clips, and before we get too far ahead of ourselves, I want to actually listen to early on, right before the credits start to roll, because, partly because it's something that's in the soundtrack, which means that I knew the lines, you know, 20 years before I ever saw the movie, and it was so much fun to, like, see them in real life.
A lot of people come to restaurants.
A lot of walnuts.
Pretty smart, huh?
Pretty smart. I'm ready. Let's do it right now, right here. Come on.
All right. Same as last time, remember? Your crowd control. I handle employees.
Mm-hmm. I love you, pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool. This is a robbery.
Any one of you fucking pricks move, and I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you.
So that's your Independence Day speech, Greta? You've got
that
one
totally.
In the bag?
Yep, exactly. She's like, all right, motherfuckers, let's go.
So is that how the album starts? Like the soundtrack album starts with the dialogue there, and then
All right, it's not even that much dialogue, actually. I think it might even just be I love yous, or just like, all right, this is a stick up. And then it goes into Misery Lou, which is like such a great track.
Right.
And it's just
I feel like I should speak for the privilege of age and tell you guys and remind you how much this movie changed. It made Dick Dale famous again, the guitarist who's playing Misery Lou, you just heard. It revived the career of John Travolta, who, after being hailed as one of the great movie actors of all time in the early 80s, had kind of started sliding down to like doing the voice of babies and Look Who's Talking and its sequel. In fact, there's a story I remember of like Quentin Tarantino like just desperately wanting to cast John Travolta, and people were like, John Travolta, he's a has-been. And how Tarantino like went to Travolta's house and was like, what happened to you, man? You're a great actor. Why are you voicing babies? So it made Travolta into star again. It totally made Samuel.
You know who the other guy was who voiced a baby in Look Who's Talking and Look Who's Talking 2, though, don't you?
Who?
I actually ended up looking this up. Bruce Willis.
Oh, yeah.
Those
That's
are the
true.
Only other movies that Travolta and Willis are in. And you know what's really weird about that?
What?
Amy Heckerling wrote those movies.
Oh, my gosh.
And she wrote Clueless.
We're creating a Nerdette Recaps bubbleverse.
This
of
is our how we connect strange. Pulp Fiction to Clueless, which I just thought was really weird. Anyway, Peter,
and
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Please keep going.
Please. I'm sorry. Did I interrupt your train of thought? Please proceed. No. Oh, are you finished? Then let me retort. Samuel L. Jackson went from a character actor who a lot of directors like Spike Lee loved to work with, but was like definitely like an ensemble character actor. Like 5 years before, he had played a character in the great movie Sea of Love called Black Guy. That's where he was. And this movie like started the extraordinary legend of Samuel L. Jackson. Did you know that Samuel L. Jackson is the most profitable movie star of all time, that his movies have made more money than any other single actor, and that's primarily because of the Star Wars movies, the prequels.
That's awesome.
True. But yeah, and this all started it. Everybody was like, holy, I guess I shouldn't say, but yes. And it totally started this genre of Tarantino-esque movies. There are so many movies, like Guy Ritchie's movies, his early movies in Britain, that are all about gangsters and their fast-moving patter.
What is it? Is it something, something, smoking
yeah,
barrels?
Yeah, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Yep.
And all that. There's so and there's like Boondock Saints and all these movies about, you know, tough, wisecracking guys and dialogue rich with pop culture reference, all coming from this movie. It changed a lot.
Witty men with guns.
Witty men with guns. There you go.
It's also worth noting that this was the breakout movie for Miramax.
Yes, that's
which is
also
the company
true.
Owned by Harvey Weinstein. So this was sort of like his rise.
Yeah, his. It's funny when you see his name on the screen, you're like, ugh, there he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is why he got to be so powerful and rich.
It also technically was a Disney movie.
Had Disney bought Miramax by that time?
Based on some single sourced internet research I did, yeah, they had just. This was the first movie post the Disney acquisition, I think. So it's technically a Disney movie, which I just think is really funny because of how violent it is.
Let's listen to a voicemail from someone who does not agree with us.
Oh.
This is Glenn.
Hey, Nerdette, Peter. This is Glenn from Pueblo, Colorado. Pulp Fiction. Quentin Tarantino. Self-indulgence is the only way I can describe him, and Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill 1 and 2 have made it mandatory for me to miss all of his other movies. They may be good. I don't know. He's just such a douchebag. Thank you.
It is hard not to... It's weird. I can't think of another movie maker. Like Richard Linklater, we talked about last week. Like I've seen many Richard Linklater movies. I've liked some, didn't like last week, so that's fine. I have no personal opinion about Richard Linklater. I don't know what he's like. I'm sure he's a very nice man. But it's true, there's something about Quentin Tarantino movies that even if you've never met the man, you have very strong opinions about him. Yeah. Because his personality and his interests are so on display.
I also like that voicemail started as though he was reciting a telegram.
Or, you know, it's poetry. It's douchebag poetry.
Quentin Tarantino, stop. although he brought up something. First of all, I think that Pulp Fiction is a much, much, much better movie than the Kill Bill movies, which I do not think are very good.
I saw those and didn't love them either.
And here's something that many people on the internet had noticed. I didn't notice. I was aware of it at the time. But when Mia, Uma Thurman's character, is explaining to Vince about the pilot that she did, and she describes it. I forget what it's called. The Furious
Foxy...
Fox Force 5.
Fox Force 5.
She's describing Kill Bill. That's basically Kill Bill. That Kill Bill was about this group of assassins and she was one of them and there were four other. That's basically Kill Bill. And
that's cool.
And I mean, did Tarantino know that one day he actually wanted to write that movie? I don't know.
With racist tropes? I'm sure he did.
Yeah. But with racist tropes and bizarre misogyny? Yes. I don't know. But I mean, if you want to talk about like the difference between a good Tarantino movie, which is this one, and a bad one like Kill Bill, all he's got is stuff he learned in the movies. He just wanted to make a cool Chinese Hong Kong style kung fu movie. He wanted to do cool fights. He reused tropes that he had seen his whole life. And it's just like, ugh. But Pulp Fiction, there's a lot of really cool, new, interesting, original stuff going on. And I thought that even seeing it again after how many years?
They're speaking of that scene where they're at, what is the diner called?
It's called Jack Rabbit Slim's,
which I looked up. It actually, they built that set for the film. I think that was the most expensive set that they made for it. It was about $150,000. Let's listen to a clip of it. This was probably my favorite moment of Mia and Vincent interacting in that scene.
Don't you hate that?
Hate what?
Uncomfortable silences. Why do we feel it's necessary to yak about bullshit in order to be comfortable?
I don't know. That's a good question.
That's when you know you found somebody really special. And you can just shut the fuck up for a minute, comfortably share silence.
Well, I don't think we're quite there yet, but don't feel bad. We just met each other.
Tell you what. I'm gonna go to the bathroom and powder my nose. You sit here and think of something to say.
I'll do that.
I just love that. Partly because it also reminded me of that line from Best in Show when she says, "We can talk or not talk for hours."
Did you guys notice who the waiter is? Who Buddy Holly the waiter is?
Yeah, it's Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, yeah.
Who was doing an uncredited bit. And he had starred in Reservoir Dogs, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things, there are a lot of, I'm surprised by how many positive things I have to say, both about the movie and about Tarantino, but I'm just going to go with it. He's really good with actors. He gets really great performances out of actors, which is weird for a writer-director who often, you know, because he's in total control, he'll want the actors to do a particular thing.
Won't let them do it the way
right.
they
I mean, the most extreme example of that is George Lucas and the Star Wars prequels, where basically he wouldn't let the actors do anything except seriously intone all his terrible dialogue with
oh,
no emotion.
No.
Natalie Portman and Hayden Christensen.
Poor Natalie Portman, yeah.
Oh.
Who
I mean,
both
those
good
are two
actors.
People who've done, yeah, they've done other great movies, or at least good movies.
But they weren't allowed to do anything like, "I worry about the future of the Trade Alliance." And because that's what George Lucas wanted. And the fact that, like, Samuel Jackson is so great in this movie, to pick one of the many actors, is because Quentin Tarantino allowed him to be that great. And that's to everybody's credit.
That reminds me of a note we got from Nick in his voicemail, which is, it's weird realizing that this is when Samuel L. Jackson became a megastar, because before this, he was just the ninth most famous person in Jurassic Park.
Yes, that's true. and very miscast. I don't know what he's doing in that movie. And it's weird. If you go back and you see, like, Jurassic Park, say, or at the end of the other movies he did before this, you're like, why are they wasting Samuel L. Jackson?
Right.
Why don't they give him a Jerry Curl wig and a gun and let him go nuts?
Don't they understand who's in their movie? Yeah,
it's Samuel L. Jackson.
So one of the other things that I knew, probably the first thing that I ever knew about this movie, is that it featured John Travolta wearing a University of California Santa Cruz banana,
yes,
slugs,
banana slugs
t-shirt, because my parents are banana slugs.
Oh,
that's where they met, right?
That's where they met. Yeah. So it's one of those weird, like, you know, never having seen Pulp Fiction, but I would say my parents went to UC Santa Cruz, and people would be like, "Oh, cool, Pulp Fiction." I'm like, yeah, man, totally.
I have no idea, really.
Which then is funny, because also I went to St. Olaf, which one of the Golden Girls characters did, and I've still never seen Golden Girls, but that's one that comes up.
Golden
it's like,
Girl.
Oh, yeah, Golden Girls. It's like, I mean.
I went to Harvard. It never comes up in any movie. The, heyo.
Heyo. Can
I'm
we jingle
sorry,
that,
I had
please?
To make that joke.
Yeah,
I feel like that's
you got
a good jingle
referencing Harvard.
Yeah.
3 minutes has it been since Peter's mentioned Harvard. What a colossal tool.
Man, thank God we have a specific Harvard patriarchy
Pollen
jingle
Storm,
that we can play.
I appreciate you.
This may be, in many, many hours of, like, podcast with you two, the first time I've ever actually mentioned I went to Harvard. That was a preemptive jingle that they recorded years ago because they knew this day would come.
Well, and isn't the thing about people who go to Harvard that they never use the H word?
Yes, that's true. I went to school in Boston. I went to school
exactly.
near Boston.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Totally.
Uh-huh. I think it's in time we need to say something mean about Quentin Tarantino before I lose my sense of balance and guilty.
Oh, okay.
He can't act, and he has always wanted to be an actor, and his cameo as Jimmy, I think his character is, is a terrible mistake. And it's only useful because you watch it and you're like, oh, yes, acting in movies is actually very hard. And wanting to do it and doing it are two very, very different things. He's just bad at it. And
I was also surprised by how long that cameo was. When I saw in the opening credits that his name was in the cast list, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, there'll be like a little moment where he's like a cashier at a store.
Well, like
or
Kathy
something.
Griffith is in this movie and you see her for 3 seconds and that's it.
Jeez, where do you see Kathy Griffith? I forget.
She's the one, oh my gosh, what is the line? She's helping out Bruce Willis after he is in that car crash.
Oh, right. She's in the crowd of women. Yeah.
If you need someone to go to court, I will be glad to help, okay? That guy was a drunken maniac. He hit you, and then he crashed into that car.
Who?
Him.
I'll be damned.
Yeah, and Julia Sweeney's in. All these people who are, like, are movie actors and can act and can project a personality to a camera. It's really hard to do, and he can't do it. And It's like the only really wrong thing about this movie is his appearance. It's like, why are you here?
It's also the moment that made me realize again how old this movie is because of how much he has aged.
Yes.
Because even like Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, because they are movie stars whose faces are their jobs, like they're kept in like, you know, whatever goo Hollywood people are kept in to keep them from aging as much as the rest of us. But Tarantino has for sure aged.
Well, and with Travolta too, like he already looked aged in this movie compared to Grease, right?
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
It
yeah,
was
yeah,
like...
Yeah.
Like, he already lost some of that, I think.
You're right. And you guys, again, I'm just going to pull age rank. You the moment where he gets up to dance in Jackrabbit Slims was huge because... Saturday Night Fever. He had, you know, he was almost, this is an exaggeration, he was like Gene Kelly. He was the greatest dancer on film.
Totally.
He was amazing. And the years had gone by and people had forgotten about him and he had gotten older because, as you say, he had come to fame as a very young man, as a teenager, basically. And then to see this older John Travolta get up and dance, and oh my God, he
that
can still dance.
So cool.
It was so great.
Did you guys see just in the last few weeks, I think it was, Lawrence Fishburne, who was apparently supposed to play the Jules role, said that just recently that the reason he turned down the role is that he didn't like the way it glorified the use of heroin, the movie.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Given how many people have died of opioids since this movie came out, that's a little hard, that it's just sort of this quirky thing about this character. Oh, you know, he likes to read novels in the toilet. He likes to shoot up. It's all cool, man. It's like, no, it's not cool.
Oh, that scene was so hard to watch.
Well, yeah. And even, I mean, if that leads us to Mia almost dying... of this overdose.
Yeah, so that was one of those things. I knew there was an overdose in the movie. I had no idea the person survived, actually. I thought Mia died.
Well, let me ask you guys about this, because this is the difference between seeing the movie for the first time. One of the things about this movie that I kind of both love about it and kind of resent about it is how many times it sets up an expectation of what's going to happen and then totally turns another direction, right? So Tarantino... very effectively sets up almost from the very first moment where they're talking about the guy who gave Mia a foot massage,
mm-hmm.
how incredibly perilous it is for Vince, John Travolta, to go and take Mia out on the town. And everything that happens between them, from Travolta walking into the house and Mia watching him on the screens like a predator choosing her next victim, mm-hmm. to the date where they genuinely seem to enjoy each other, where he... is legitimately convinced to come out of his shell and actually start relating to her as a person and not just somebody to be terrified of. Everything they do leads up to the audience's expectation that when they get back to the house, he's going to make a terrible mistake and start like making out with her or something like that. And something terrible is going to happen. And you wonder,
I love those bathroom pep talk scenes.
Right.
Yeah,
anti-pep talk.
And that is exactly the scene. You're just going to say goodnight. You're going to thank her. You're going to go home. You're going to jerk off. That's what you're going to do. That is a perfect setup for him coming out and then something very different happening.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then she reaches into his coat, which has been there the whole time. He's holding that coat in that famous little walking back and forth meme that's been there the whole time. He has, while you were paying attention to something else, he set that up, that there's this heroin in the pocket, that she snorts cocaine. It's all been there the whole time. She snorts cocaine, and all of a sudden the scene goes completely different than anybody led to expect.
Can I ask a thing, just because I've never seen cocaine or heroin up close?
I'm so surprised.
But like, is it logical, I guess, that she was maybe thinking that was cocaine? And so it was like, you just wouldn't be able to tell the difference between powdered heroin and powdered cocaine before you put it in your nose? Or did she think she was snorting heroin?
Like a lot of public radio people, I have vast experience with illicit drugs. And no, I actually, that I had to look up as well. As you can imagine, this movie has had so much commentary and analysis.
Yeah.
Did you guys stumble into the whole Band-Aid theory?
Mm-hmm.
Then what's in the briefcase is Marcellus Wallace's soul, and it was removed by the devil through the hole in the back of his head, which is what the Band-Aid is. People have spent a lot of time talking about this movie.
Yeah.
People have pointed out that there's an exchange when Travolta is buying drugs from Eric Stoltz, and Eric Stoltz says...
balloon or baggie.
Yeah, do you mind if I use a baggie because I'm out of a balloon? And he's like, yeah, no problem. So he puts the heroin in a baggie, and apparently at the time, cocaine came in baggies... heroin came in balloons, which is...
So it was an honest mistake.
Honest mistake.
Not
an
attempt to snort coke or snort heroin.
Yeah. So I know what I tell you on the internet. I am not professing, ladies and gentlemen, to have any idea.
I mean,
that's
kind of what I had gathered and assumed too. But I mean, that just makes it all the more brilliant to me, the writing of it, where it's like, oh, no, that exact one line of dialogue with Lance earlier is so that you can set up this moment later.
Right.
Right. Like this one little thing where I was like, this is kind of an odd moment where they're just discussing what to put the drugs in.
Right.
And then it becomes the, you know, the thing that causes the overdose later.
Let me ask you guys this. When I saw the movie, you know, this was during my, I was playwriting. I was thinking constantly about narrative. I remember being cheated, feeling cheated that that particular scene, and we can talk about this again with the whole sequence with Bruce Willis and the gold watch. I remember feeling cheated. I was like, oh man, there's going to be a really difficult, awkward, tense scene as they work out their mutual attraction and either make a terrible mistake or not or whatever. And then when she snorted the heroin, all of a sudden, that never comes up again. You know, it's like, no, we're not going to make out. That's like totally a non-issue now. And I remember feeling cheated, which I don't now. Now I'm like, that's a much more interesting place to take the scene than where we all thought was going it. And I admired the misdirection. How did you guys feel the same way?
I wasn't disappointed by it.
It gave them a very different kind of secret to have to keep.
Yeah.
And that moment where she's walking back inside and said, like, I would be in as much trouble as you if this story came out, was really sad. Like, it's such a, it's like the one and maybe first and only honest moment of her character.
Yeah.
Because she's just almost died, and so, like, her guard is down a little bit more, whereas, like, she spends every moment up to that point, like, pretending to be someone. And then in that moment, she's like, oh, no, my husband is terrifying, and I do drugs because my life is awful, and please don't tell anyone. Like, there's so much subtext in that moment and so much honesty in that moment.
Yeah, and I realized something that I didn't realize when I was younger and more critical, as we've discussed, which is that he's not avoiding the issue of Marcellus killing him if he touches his wife, because, man, does he end up touching his wife. It also reminded me of something that we were talking about before, that the only way that Tarantino can think of people relating is in terms of violence, which is often terrible, but it's often sweet. Like, the consummation of their relationship isn't sex. It's him stabbing her in the chest with a needle to save her life.
Yeah.
And like, that's the nicest thing anybody does for anybody else in this movie, almost, until we get to the end. He's like, oh, I'm going to do this terrible, violent thing to you and save your life. And that's, I just kept coming back to it. It's like, how else do people relate to each other in Tarantino movies except violence or the threat of violence?
You know what? And I want to talk about that specific scene when he does save her life, but let's do it right after a break. Let's listen. Partly what I thought was so fascinating about that scene is how funny it managed to be, even though we were dealing with like a very intense overdose. Let's listen to some of it.
She's getting shot. I'm gonna go get my little black medical book.
The fuck you need a medical book for?
What to do? I never had to give an adrenaline
shot. You've never given an adrenaline shot?
I never had to, all right? I don't go toy popping with a bunch of bubble gummers. My friends can't handle their
heart. Get the shot!
Look, I am if you let me.
I someone fucking stop.
Well, stop talking to me. Start talking
get
to her.
Get shot! Right.
One of the things that I admire, again, I find so much more I like about this movie than I thought, is like that scene, if you describe the plot, is like Vince brings Mia to the house, gets a shot of adrenaline, which I don't know if it actually saves people from an overdose. This is before Narcan. And stabs her and gives her a shot and wakes her up. That's what happens. And yet it's such a tense scene, and it's partially tense because of all those actors freaking out. About can you find the book? Can you not find the book? Where's the shot? And it's great because their anxiety and terror is contagious. It's like they're running around like terrified, like they know what the fuck is going to happen. And you're like, I don't know what the fuck's going to happen either.
Yeah. I did like that there was one like real high person, though, that one girl who was just sort of like kind of paying attention. And then at the very, like, there's this great moment in a shot that's sort of like a little bit like POV of Mia, where it's like all the faces sort of over her.
Yep.
And then the real high girl just kind of like leans into frame. Like, I guess I'll watch this.
Yeah.
It's better than what's
and
on TV.
Adds. And there's a great shot that, again, I hadn't noticed before of Travolta driving up. And if you watch it, it's like one continuous shot. It's like, no, don't show up here. And all of a sudden he hears the voice,
and
hears the sound
the
of Travolta.
House. Yeah.
And he looks out and the car speeds by to from your right to the left. There's a sound of a crash. And you follow the camera. The camera follows Stoltz as he runs out, and there's the crashed car and Travolta pulling Uma Thurman out of it. And you're like, how did they do that? Mm-hmm. That's a great sequence.
Well, and did you guys read about how they did the stabbing the needle in shot?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Movie magic? It's just a reverse shot. It's just him pulling his hand away from her chest really quickly so that he could, like, you could see some sort of, like, real movement, and it didn't need to actually stop at her chest.
So what you're saying is it was just old school boomerang effect.
Ooh. It was old school boomerang.
Let's listen to another voicemail. We haven't really discussed Bruce Willis's stuff at all yet. So let's hear from Lee, and then we can talk about Bruce.
Okay.
Hi, Nerdettes and Peter. This is Lee from North Carolina, and I really enjoy your recaps. I hope you'll keep them up. I didn't watch Pulp Fiction for several years after its release because I just didn't want to deal with the violence. And it is very violent, but it's a great movie with some wonderful performances. And it passes my Bruce Willis shirt test. Generally speaking, the sooner Bruce Willis is on screen with his shirt off, the less I like the movie. Die Hard? 15 minutes and I can't stand it. In The Sixth Sense, I think he keeps his shirt on the whole time and it's my favorite Bruce Willis movie. Pulp Fiction? A respectable hour and 12 minutes. Of course, that's about a minute into a second scene, but it's balanced by the rest of the movie. Thanks for this series of recaps.
Is this a widely held opinion that people, that ladies do not want to see Bruce Willis take his shirt off?
I would have argued the reverse.
Yeah, when she started, I was like,
oh, great, shirtless Bruce Willis.
Yeah, if he doesn't take his shirt off in the first half an hour, I'm not interested. But I was interested with the turn that took.
I love Lee's spreadsheet that she's got somewhere.
Isn't that amazing?
112 minutes.
It's pretty good. So yeah, I would say, like, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have been mad if that entire thing were lifted out. And I understand the importance of it from, like, the different timing of things and the mosaic.
I'm sorry, the entire thing? You mean the entire...
The entire Bruce Willis storyline.
Which, like, is called the Gold Watch.
The Gold Watch. Yeah, like the backstory about the watch, the fight, the running away, especially the then, like, you know, I guess seeing him shoot John Travolta is, like, maybe just up till that I was fine with. But then once it started getting extremely violent and, like, sadistic and terrifying,
it gets really weird. I mean, again, there's this sense of misdirection. Like, he spends that amazing scene with Christopher Walken, that very famous monologue.
About,
like, I carried this hunk of metal up my ass for 5 years. So you set up, he needs that watch. This is why the watch is so meaningful. This is why it's basically a MacGuffin speech. We need this thing. And then there's that scene where he finds out his amusing girlfriend has forgotten it, and you understand exactly why it's so upsetting.
But do you? It's so farcical, though, you know?
If you were sitting down as a screenwriting exercise and said, okay, it's important for this character to want a particular object or possession so much that he's willing to risk his life to get it, could you do a better job of setting that up than creating that backstory of that gold watch and where it came from and what it meant to him? I mean, it's like,
yeah,
it's
I think it would not involve hiding it in my butt.
Well, you're not Quentin Tarantino.
You know? Right. No, I mean, I'm sure it's probably the best version Tarantino could come up with, but I think there are plenty of examples of, like, using 3 minutes to explain why something is important to a character that are more effective, for sure. Not in a Tarantino film,
maybe,
but
not
for sure out there. Yes,
even seeing him fiddle with that watch in his pocket nervously or something when he has that first scene with Ving Rhames,
I didn't even notice,
like,
that.
No, I'm saying there could have been a moment of the watch.
Yes,
like,
right.
We had our first whole interaction with him has no watch.
Yeah.
And he could have even just been, like, tapping it, or, like, even just seeing it.
Or, like,
right?
Taking it off before his fight or something, you know?
As we're about to get to, there is a lot of homosexual panic in this movie.
Yeah.
Which is the anxiety of straight men being confronted by gay people. And
Or just the idea of other men's feet.
Yeah, well, maybe, yes. Oh, yes, there's a lot. I forgot about that.
The foot massage thing at the beginning, yeah.
But having to put something up your ass plays into that. I mean, if in the Tarantino-esque masculinity world,
sure,
having to put something up your ass is, like, makes it, like, the last full measure of devotion in a weird way.
Huh.
And so I think that's why that's a part of that scene. This is how important this watch was, that it actually... Some man actually did that humiliating thing to get the watch to him.
Sure, I get that. I just don't think that actually exemplifies why this kid should actually care.
Well,
effectively.
Assuming that whether or not you buy how important the watch is, that the movie wants you to know that the watch is important. And again, there's misdirection. So he's like, oh my God, he's gotten away with this clean, this whole scheme to rip off Marcellus Wallace and make a lot of money and start a new life. But he's going to risk it all, including his own life, to get that watch back.
Well, those scenes are great. Like seeing him walk through the yard from just watching him walk.
Oh, yeah.
Like there are some really gorgeous moments leading up to it for sure.
And it's very tense.
The toaster pastries.
It's very, and again, that scene where he's in the apartment and he's like, oh, okay, I got it. I'm going to get my watch. I'm going to have some time for some toaster pastries. And he looks down and he sees the machine gun.
Yeah, on the kitchen counter.
Oh, that's great.
And then the toilet flushes.
And then Travolta walks out with that book in his hand.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's great.
And you can imagine if Tarantino had to pitch this to somebody, and he goes back and he's just lucky enough to walk in when the moment when Travolta's on the toilet and he left his gun out. You're like, oh, yeah, really? Great. Then what happens? Well, then he gets away. Oh, really? Okay, well, then what happens? Well, then he runs into Marcellus Wallace.
With a box of donuts.
Because Marcellus Wallace had left the apartment to go get some donuts and bring it back just at that very moment. It's like, oh, really? Then what happens? Well, then they have a fight. Oh, then what happens? Then they get kidnapped by crazy hillbilly racist homosexual racists. And trapped in a basement. And you're like,
yeah, why?
What?
Why?
That was definitely the moment I said what out loud. I said what out loud? What? What?
Well, and it's funny because
what now? I think what I said was, what now?
I think the thing that gets me is that the storyline with Travolta and Thurman, it fits in with the rest of the story and where the story goes in a way that the Willis stuff doesn't. Like, I really think you could take all of that out and it would work still, pretty much, you know?
Hmm. Well, in a weird way, except in a Tarantino movie, it couldn't. And again, I go back to his emphasis of violence as the only way people relate to each other. So,
right, but I guess what I'm saying is it's one thing if we see Marcellus have a change of heart after that that impacts the rest of the story. But as it is, it's completely self-isolated, you know?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, Marcellus Wallace exists in the movie as just a source of danger. He's not really
right, I mean,
character,
you don't even see
almost.
His face
he's just,
until that car crash.
Yeah, he's just the big bad guy who can hurt anybody he likes, and that sort of overshadows the whole Vince and Mia thing, and it overshadows this. And the problem, again, for the characters is how is Bruce Willis going to escape with his life after betraying Marcellus?
Right.
And the answer that Tarantino provides is Bruce Willis, is going to save Marcellus from horrible violence by committing violence of his own.
Right.
That's how it works
in
the Tarantino world. They're not going to have a conversation about it.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right. That's the only way it can work. And in this universe, it works. I mean, would you believe if they sat down and talked it out? No.
I hear you. I still just don't think it actually matters, but that's okay.
I was just going to say, too, that it feels like, I think, Peter, you called it bizarre misogyny, which is a good way of putting it, because it's not normal misogyny. It's extra.
No,
it's its own Tarantino sort of misogyny.
It's a different flavor.
In that scene in particular, where they're in that weird dungeon-y basement, and there's the line about, is Grace okay up front? I, for that whole scene, was thinking there's like some female character running the store while they're downstairs. And then, of course, no, Grace is the name of the motorcycle.
The chopper.
Right.
The chopper.
The chopper.
So maybe the only time, except between Honey Bunny and Ringo, that you hear someone express actual concern for a female, it's not actually a woman, it's a chopper.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of concern for Mia. There's a lot of people caring.
But it's much more possessive.
No, but they're concerned about what happens to Wallace's property.
Yeah.
Not what happens to Mia,
right.
The person.
That's
for sure.
Absolutely
for
right.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I concede that point.
Let's listen to a voicemail from Jesse, because this brings up something that we have not yet discussed that I think we should, in terms of what does and doesn't hold up about this film.
I think I know what this is going to be.
Yeah.
I still think that the use of the racist language, the N-word in particular, is a problem. And I think it was harmful, because I think it actually sort of, for my generation of people who were in high school around that time, it sort of suggested that maybe it was okay to use that word as long as you were doing it kind of ironically, and especially for white people, as long as you weren't intending it as a racial slur. And so I think it kind of created this idea that was an okay word to use by white people. And I think it took some people a while to figure out that that was actually harmful.
You know what, Justin, should we listen to Christina and Nick right now also? Because they kind of mentioned the same thing.
Hi, Nerdette.
It's Katrina.
And Nick.
We live in Chicago.
So we just watched Pulp Fiction, and for the most part, I think it's fine. The direction is really great, but a lot of the writing, I always kind of feel this way with Quentin Tarantino, where I kind of feel like it's an excuse for him to type a bunch of slurs that he can't really get away with saying in real life, but then he also gets to direct himself saying them, and that always feels a little weird.
I hated Pulp Fiction when I watched it in 2015, and now that I walked into it knowing that these people were terrible, terrible humans who make terrible choices, like don't do drugs and drive a car, don't do drugs and mix them with other drugs so you overdose, don't take the person who overdosed to your drug dealer. So many terrible choices. But it is a really well-directed film, so I don't hate it as much as I did 5 years ago.
Katrina and I clearly would have been friends in high school.
Yeah, well, she brings up some really good points.
She absolutely does.
But yeah, the racial slur thing, I think these two mentioned, like, there are just a lot of racial slurs, like, against a lot of different people. And, like, I was probably more shocked by some of those other words just because I have not...
Remind me of the other ones.
There are words for Asian people. There are words
for... especially, you know, in the context of, like, the Vietnam War when Christopher Walken is talking. You know, like, there's some...
Well, and let's be honest. It feels different to hear Samuel L. Jackson say some of those words than it does to watch Quentin Tarantino, to Nick's point, write them for himself.
Right.
It does feel self-indulgent, and it does feel really gross for him to be like, I get to be a white guy who says this on screen.
Yep. Everything I'm about to say is not like my opinion. Like, this is okay, but how we thought about it when the movie came out.
How white people you knew.
And how people reacted to it for the most part was, well, he's writing about these cool, violent characters who aren't realistic. It's like these weird gang. I mean, these gangsters dress in black suits. And so, yes, it's totally legit that it's part of this fictional pulpy, to take the title of the movie, it's overt, world that these guys throw around racist stuff with complete lack of even hostility. They're just saying it because that's the word they use. And people also forgave Tarantino a lot because, among other things, there are so many great black characters in this movie. I mean, the coolest guy in this movie is Samuel L. Jackson. So you got to, people weighed that against the racist slurs. Well, yeah, on the one hand, he's using the N-word a lot. But on the other hand, look what he did for this character. It's amazing.
Like, the coolest and the most emotionally sort of complex and has actually maybe a character arc.
Yeah.
Right.
All those things.
All that's there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, at the time, there were people who went against that. Like, no, it's not cool. Yeah. And it's not a word that you can just throw around to make your characters sound street and hip and tough. It's a word with a lot of terrible meanings for a lot of people. There's a story, I couldn't find it, of, because Tarantino became the screenwriter of the moment. He was writing movies for a lot of other people to direct, which didn't continue to go on for a while for obvious reasons. And he wrote a movie, I can't remember what it's called. It's this submarine thriller with Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington. And everybody listening to this movie is shouting out the name of the movie. I can't remember it.
Oh, Crimson Tide is the movie you're thinking of.
Crimson Tide, thank you. There's a story that Tarantino's on set because he was brought in to rework the screenplay to make it cool. And Denzel Washington walks over to him and says, Quentin, let me talk to you about the N-word.
Mm.
And let me tell you about what I feel like when I hear your character say that word. And gave him an immense amount of grief over it. And that to me would be terrifying if Denzel Washington were to walk over to me and tell me that he was unhappy with me.
That's classy as fuck, I feel like. Like, good for him.
Yeah. And there are the other people who have come out and talked about it. Spike Lee has been on record saying,
this is not cool. Seems unnecessary.
No. It's a no. And the thing is the movie, you could have subtracted all of those words.
Oh, yeah, totally. You still got plenty, like hundreds of fucks.
Yeah.
You know? You do.
Yeah.
And we're not even talking. I mean, we're getting into this. And to me, one of the most problematic things about the movie that I forgive it a lot for all the reasons I've said is what happens to that character in the back of the seat, the guy who gets his head blown off.
Marvin.
Because again, there's that misdirection. You know, they've gotten the briefcase, they've gotten away, they've killed the guys, nobody's been caught, even though they hung out in the apartment after shooting guns for a long time. Nobody bothered to call it in.
Can we listen to a clip, actually? Because that was one of the divine intervention moment I thought was really fascinating. It kind of speaks to Samuel L. Jackson's character, too.
We should be fucking dead, man.
I know, we was lucky.
No, that shit wasn't luck.
Yeah, maybe.
This was divine intervention. You know what divine intervention is?
I think so. That means that God came down from heaven and stopped the bullets?
That's right. That's exactly what it means. God came down from heaven and stopped these motherfucking bullets.
I think it's time for us to leave, Jules.
Don't do that. Don't fucking blow this shit off. What just happened here was a fucking miracle.
Chill, Jules. This shit happens.
Wrong. This shit doesn't just happen.
Do you want to continue this theological discussion in a car or in a jailhouse with the cops?
We should be fucking dead, my friend. What happened here was a miracle, and I want you to fucking acknowledge it.
All right, it was a miracle. Can we go now?
I have to say, I really did love just like the strange spirituality of Pulp Fiction. I was very surprised by that.
That leads to not only my favorite scene in the movie, but probably the single best scene that Tarantino has ever done, which is the climax of the movie.
Yeah.
Leading up to that great speech where he lets them go.
At the diner and quoting Ezekiel again and paying him so he doesn't have to kill him.
Yes. I realize that I am the tyranny of evil men, but I'm trying to be the shepherd, Ringo. I'm trying really hard. Because in a movie in which we've basically, as I've been saying all along, it's all about violence and people threatening other people with violence and doing violence to other people for whatever motivation, somebody choosing not to be violent, mm-hmm. that character
mm-hmm. yeah.
choosing not to be violent is like the most moving human thing that Quentin Tarantino is capable of. And I got to tell you, I mean, it's more than just admiring it. Like, wow, that's really great movie making and acting. It's like I've actually taken that to heart when I have been like in a tough situation where I am tempted to give in to my worst instincts and act out of anger. I say to myself, no, man, I'm trying to be the shepherd. So I just to me that last scene makes up for a lot of the, shall we say, problematic stuff we've talked about and is totally real.
I think that's actually a really nice note to wrap on, that we have one more voicemail and then we can all go watch Toy Story, I guess.
I guess so.
Here's Stephanie.
Hi, Nerdette. This is Stephanie from Missouri. Last week, you guys were talking about Dazed and Confused, and Greta discussed how she was more interested in the distance between her and her crush on the couch than she was in the movie. And I immediately thought of Pulp Fiction. The only good thing I have to say about Pulp Fiction was that I first watched it on the very first date with the man who would become my husband. And after the movie ended, we looked at each other with such confused looks. You might say we were dazed and confused. Granted, this was in around 2005, so the movie had already amassed quite the cult following, but we could neither one understand the appeal. I, however, completely understood my appeal for him, and we just celebrated our 10th wedding anniversary. I realize that we are in the minority of people who didn't get it, and we've made peace with that. Thanks so much. Love your show.
How nice is that?
It was sweet. I love sweet it's people very nice. Calling in.
A mutual confusion of Pulp Fiction, bringing people together since 2010 or whatever it was. Mm.
Greta, we have to actually end on a correction last week. Speaking of Dazed and Confused, which is that our friend Amy wants us to know that Anthony Rapp was not in Empire Records.
Oh, yes, I know. We did get a message about that.
I didn't know.
Too.
I've never seen Empire Records.
So,
all right.
She specifically filed. I appreciate that she didn't tweet at us about our misspeaking, but she just.
Oh, I did get an email that there is a character who is in both, but it is not Anthony Rapp
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in my defense.
So just, you know, shout out to Amy for gently correcting us.
Her Broadway musical knowledge precedes her. Okay, so next week we're going to watch Toy Story.
Yay!
Yeah, we
a complete 180. I'm really looking forward to some just like wholesome kindness, you know?
Some Randy Newman.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be great.
Some T. Hanks, our old pal T. Hanks.
T. Hanks.
Our old pal, your friend and mine. By the way, I'm just going to say this. If you people listening to this have not heard the Nerdep episode from 2017 in which Tom Hanks guested and talked about typewriters, basically talking about typewriters for half an hour without an intake of breath.
We got like two questions in the entire time, and it's delightful.
It's my favorite thing.
The most amazing thing you have ever heard. I highly recommend it to everybody. It's
the
great.
Typewriter that he's playing around on is my typewriter from real life, and it's sitting right next to me right now. It's my Hanksian typewriter.
Yes, the Tom Hanks's monologue about typewriters, which he made up on the spot, is one of the greatest works of literature I've ever had the pleasure of encountering.
We should tweet that out again for people, because it really is a nice respite from the rest of the world to just listen to Tom Hanks.
It is delightful.
And his joy.
It is truly delightful.
Sorry.
The patriarchy's speaking, so ladies be quiet. Peter Sagal is the worst.
Because I cleared my throat, Justin?
Listen, don't question the producer, okay?
Justin's got an itchy trigger finger over there. What can you say? The jingle just went off, Peter. He doesn't know what happened.
The podcast hit a bump.
All right, that's it for this week. Many thanks to all of you who called in with voicemails. Those were great. If you want to keep in touch with us before next week's episode, of course, you can do that over on the Twitters. I am at Greta M. Johnson. Trisha is at Trisha Bobita, and Peter is at Peter Sagal. The show is produced by me and Justin Bull. Our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak, and our Superfly theme music is composed by Andrew Edwards of Blue Police Box Music. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.